praying is your work.
Exactly.
And then everything else is the periphery.
Around it, yeah.
Right?
Definitely.
So we lose track of life and our purpose in life because, like, you think, oh, what I'm doing is for the sake of God. I'm recording all these Islamic programs. I'm making content for Islamic website or whatever. But all that, if you're really true in your intention, your prayer has to be a true prayer. And there is one beautiful, beautiful verse in the Noble Quran in chapter Ankabut, meaning the spider, verse number 45, that really gives you a golden treasure, Zainab. Seriously. Somebody asked Ayatollah Behjat, how do I know if my prayer is valid or not? If I'm praying, if, you know, if my I'm doing my prayers in its right manner. And you know what he answered? This verse of the Noble Quran. He said, well, let me recite this verse for you. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Recite what has been revealed to you of the book. So your connection with the Quran. And establish prayers. Indeed, genuine prayer should deter one from indecency and wickedness. This is what Ayatollah Behjat said. He said, if you want to know whether your prayer is accepted by God or not, see if you're in your daily life, if there is placed in a juncture where you have to decide between the right or the left, between A or B, see which one you choose, the indecency or the decency. If your prayer is right, it will guide you. It will be like a torch. It will be like a light for you, showing you the path. And then it says, the remembrance of Allah is an even greater deterrent, and Allah fully knows what you all do. So when we're talking about Sayyidah Zainab and Imam al-Hussein and Ali Akbar, with the case of all the others, specifically with the case of, we're talking about the ladies of Ashura, with the case of Sayyidah Zainab, what made her steps firm on the path in the depth and in the heart of all these calamities is her nightly vigils, secondly, and firstly, her prayers on prime time. And even after the event of Ashura, even at that same night, she had her nightly vigils in a sitting position because of all that hardness that she had experienced that day. So there are a lot of ahadith that says, if you want the world, nightly vigils. If you want the hereafter, nightly vigils. If you want light of the face, nightly vigils.
Sustenance, nightly vigils. Good spouse, nightly vigils. Knowledge, wisdom, nightly
money,
vigils.
Money, everything. Everything is in nightly vigils. You know what? Why nightly vigils are so important? In my own limited understanding, nightly vigils is a kind of mindfulness.
It
and
is.
Kind of exercising your willpower. Your will. You know, will is like a muscle that you can train it to lift thousands of kilograms of weight or to be so weak not to be able to lift 2 grams of weight.
Definitely.
So when in the midst of sleep, you force yourself to wake up and to focus your attention on God, this is an exercise of the willpower. Right?
For sure.
So,
ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Muslim Lady here on IRIB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break. Stay with us. We're discussing the prominent qualities and the prominent women of the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, especially after the events of Ashura, and of course how to implement that into our own modern lives.
Lady Zainab, when her brother was leaving to the battlefield and was saying farewell, she was like any other woman, any other sister, so fond of her brother that when she wanted to get married to her husband, she made this
condition
that wherever Hussein goes, I go.
Beautiful.
Right?
Right.
And she brought up her children in a way that all of them were martyred for Imam al-Hussein. So she's an ordinary lady when it comes to the qualities of being gentle and feminine and being heartbroken and being very sensitive. But of course, there was this special grace that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had given her, that she was able to direct and to manage and to control the situation in such a beautiful way that not even one flaw you could see from her.
Yeah.
One instance where she made a mistake.
She slipped, she said something weird, she said something she wasn't supposed to, lashed out at someone.
Exactly. But a lot of it but was because of she had prepared the capacity to receive this grace.
For sure.
Right? By her nightly vigils.
It's very important. I mean, I'm not saying that we all got to prepare for us to, you know, someday have Ashura happen to us. But our entire lives, obviously, either have to be in preparation for the reappearance of Imam Zaman alayhi salam. He's the Hussein of our time. We have to prepare every day to do something, to be able to defend him when the time comes, to protect him when the time comes, to assist and aid him. Or just training, because every day is a test.
There's actually this verse from the Noble Quran that says, if you are, I don't exactly know which verse and I don't exactly know the wordings, but it says Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you a light to walk by.
Mm.
In all these diverse situations where you don't know what to do, which path to take, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, God says, you have been listening to me, you have been serving me, you have been doing what I say to you, now I will come to your aid.
Mm.
And I will help you, I will let you know, I will ease this path for you. You know this prayer where we say, رَبِّ اشْرَحْ لِي صَدْرِي وَيَسِّرْ لِي أَمْرِي وَحْلُلْ عُقْدَةً مِّن لِّسَانِي يَفْقَهُوا قَوْلِي. So all these prayers are answered if you are truly a servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And you see this quality, being a servant of God, in many of these personalities, the ladies of Ashura, in men, gentlemen and ladies of Ashura, right? I want to tell you another distinguished personality which was not herself present on the day of Ashura, but she had a considerable role in motivating or in helping her partner seek the truth in life.
Right.
Right? I'm sure you by now you have guessed her name. She is called Daylam or Delham, as some call her. I call her a lady leading her husband to heaven. And she was the wife of Zuhair ibn Ghain, a very known personality, a merchant, I've heard, in Kufa. And their caravan was almost going at the same pace as Imam Hussein's caravan on their way back from Mecca. And he purposefully wanted not to meet Imam Hussein, and he would camp one or two stops forward or behind Imam Hussein so they wouldn't have to meet. In the last stop, they were forced to stop very close to one another, where they were resting, and Imam al-Hussein sent a messenger, called him, summoned him to come to his tent. And of course, he didn't want to go. He didn't want to see Imam Hussein. But this is where a heavenly lady comes in the picture and makes a great change. She, Delham, went to her husband and said, the son of the prophet's daughter is calling you and you're ignoring him? Isn't it better if you just go and then you can decide what to do, you know, when you come back?
Yep.
And Zuhair went to see Imam Hussein, and that meeting changed his life
forever.
Yeah, he said Delham's last request was for her husband to remember her in the presence of the noble prophet when he was martyred. I think he let her go. Zuhair let Delham
divorced him
so that he wouldn't be attached to Zuhair, because after the calamity of Ashura, obviously maybe they would captivate his wife as well if they found that they were somehow related. I heard somewhere that she was a witness to the event of Ashura, and she was a heavenly lady. So
It comes to show, really, what a single nudge can do to a person's fate. The single proper push.
At the right time. At the right place. Exactly. With the right intensity.
Exactly. Anything could have just changed the direction of her and his life forever.
She knew that he was going to be martyred, that she was going to lose him.
But that's the thing about Ashura. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Muslim Lady. Thank you so very much, Sister Razia, and thank you to our listeners for being with us. Until another greeting, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. That somehow you tell me out aloud that on that day I'll be okay.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Today is the 9th of Muharram, known as Tasua. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, said, Tasua is the day in which Hussein, peace upon him, and his companions were besieged in Karbala. The troop of Sham encircled him and blocked his way. And the son of Marjan ibn Ziyad and Umar Sa'd were rejoicing of having a big troop, and they considered Hussein and his companions as weak and were certain that Hussein would have no more helper and companion, and the people of Iraq would not come to his assistance. The encampment of Imam Hussein has had no water for a few days, as Umar Sa'd has blocked their access to water. Children are thirsty and restless. These pressures are aimed at forcing Hussein for allegiance with Yazid, the libertine and unjust ruler. Shemr, son of Zeljoshan, joined Umar Sa'd with 4,000 forces and gave him the letter of Ibn Ziyad. Ibn Ziyad, the ruler of Kufa, had written in the letter, Umar, I have not sent you for reform with Hussein. As soon as receiving the letter, if Hussein does not accept our proposal, attack him, kill him and his companions, and after killing them, mutilate them. After killing Hussein and his companions, gallop with horses on their bodies. I know that there is no use in galloping after the death, but you should do it as I have uttered it. And if you pay attention to these words, you will be endeared to us. The letter increased movements in the troops of Umar Sa'd. They got ready for war with Hussein as they failed to force him to surrender. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, sent his brother Abbas to take respite for one night, as he loved prayer and supplication to God. Shemr was from Banu Kaab tribe and had a kinship relation with Hazrat Abbas' mother. Thus, he brought a letter of safety for him and his brothers, provided that they left Imam Hussein. Abbas roared and said strongly, "Should I be separated from Hussein? Woe on you, shame on you and your letter of safety. May God curse you and your letter of safety. Should we have safety while the son of Prophet's daughter has no safety?" It was night and dark everywhere. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, went to his companions to seal argument with them. He said, "Beware that I give you permission to leave. So all of you go, as I have taken back my allegiance and I have no promise or covenant on you. Now the night has come and it has covered you. Take it as an easy pace camel and get separated." The 72 companions of Imam Hussein encircled him with love and revised their allegiance to him. When Imam Hussein, peace upon him, returned to his tent, he saw the worried looks of Lady Zainab. So he told her, "By God, I have tested them and found them the men who have become ready and looking askance at death, and they are attached to death in my way like a suckling to his mother's breast." The loyalty of Imam Hussein's companions has become the absolute role model for the entire mankind. God says in Ayah 23 of Surah Ahzab, "Among the faithful are men who fulfill what they have pledged to Allah. Of them are some who have fulfilled their pledge, and of them are some who still wait, and they have not changed in the least." Imam Hussein, peace upon him, recited this ayah to his companions on the eve of Ashura. On the day of Ashura, Amr ibn Khalid was telling to himself, "My soul, you should move toward the compassionate God. I give you good news of life at peace and ease. On that day, you will be rewarded well." Hazrat Abbas has become famous as the epitome of loyalty and fealty among the companions of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Muslims mark the day of Tasu'a with the memory of Abbas. He was the standard bearer of Imam Hussein and the guardian of the tents. The women and children felt safe and secure as long as he was alive. The valiant brother of Imam Hussein did not spare a single moment to obey whatever the Imam told him. Ayatollah Khamenei has depicted Hazrat Abbas' loyalty and valor on the day of Ashura, saying, "The loyalty of Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas can be seen more than ever in this event of entering a branch of Euphrates and not drinking water. It has become narrated that in those moments and the last hour, these children were so thirsty that Imam Hussein and Abul Fazl went together to bring water. They went toward a branch of the Euphrates that was in the area so that they could bring water. These two brave and powerful brothers fought back to back. One of them is Imam Hussein, near 60 years old. But he was among the unique famous ones in power and bravery. Another one was his young brother of 30 and so years old. Abul Fazl Abbas, with such characteristics that everyone knew him. These two brothers, shoulder to shoulder and at times back to back, in the middle of the sea of enemy, would break through the troops to reach the water of Euphrates in order to bring water. In the middle of this tough battle, suddenly Imam Hussein feels that the enemy has distanced him from his brother Abbas. At this time, Abul Fazl gets closer to water and reaches the water. According to the narrations, he fills the water container to take it to the tents. Here, everyone feels his right to put water on his thirsty lips, but he showed his loyalty there. When Abul Fazl Abbas took water, as his eyes caught sight of water, remembered the thirsty lips of Hussein. Perhaps he remembered the cries of thirst of the girls and children in the sanctuary. Perhaps he remembered the thirsty crying of Ali Asghar and couldn't drink water. He poured water on water and came out. While coming out of the river, the events take place and he is martyred in an unmanly way.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Taliban had previously seized the capital, Kabul, on 27th of September 1996 and established their rule over Afghanistan. They declared Afghanistan as an Islamic emirate and imposed their own interpretation of Islamic law. Taliban controlled over 90% of the country from 1996 to 2001. Then, 9/11 happened. Following the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, the United States was after Al-Qaeda's leader, Osama bin Laden. Taliban helped bin Laden to hide in Afghanistan and refused to surrender him immediately, asking Washington to provide evidence that bin Laden was behind the attack. That gave the US a good excuse to invade Afghanistan and begin its so-called war on terror. Within a couple of months, the Taliban were forced out of power and a new interim government was formed in Afghanistan. After 3 years, the country had a new constitution and Hamid Karzai was the new president. While that was in progress, the Taliban had regrouped. The militants were against the presence of foreign troops and wanted them to leave Afghanistan. For the past 20 years, Afghanistan has been a scene of a devastating conflict. Over 40,000 Afghan civilians were killed, at least 64,100 Afghan military and police, as well as more than 3,500 international soldiers died. The US alone has spent around $1 trillion on war and reconstruction projects. After all that, Afghanistan remained unstable and the Taliban got stronger. Until 2021, the Taliban began a fresh round of offensives in May and took key cities one after another in just over a week, including the capital, Kabul. The Afghan president Ashraf Ghani fled the country and the Mutin group announced there would be no transitional government in Afghanistan and that it expects a complete handover of power. The situation in Afghanistan is fluid and the facts on the ground are changing rapidly. Just a month ago, the US President Joe Biden defended his decision to withdraw American troops from Afghanistan and end the 20-year war in that country. Also, he rejected the prospect of Americans fleeing Kabul, as they did from Saigon in 1975. However, the latest developments in Afghanistan proved the opposite of Biden's claims. Americans ran away from Kabul just like how they fled Saigon. The US leaders have been telling the Americans and the world that the war in Afghanistan was necessary for US security and supporting an Afghan security force that was performing well. However, all of it was nothing but a lie from the very beginning. Washington's initial objectives in Afghanistan were disrupting Al-Qaeda and punishing the Taliban. Those objectives were accomplished by March 2002. Then the US changed the mission to a nation-building operation. Washington has spent more on nation-building in Afghanistan than any other country ever. However, as soon as the military cover of US and NATO forces was withdrawn, the ugly truth was revealed. The Afghan National Security Forces were utterly incapable of thwarting the Taliban offensive. That's why security forces outnumbered the Taliban militants. They were also trained by Americans and their allies, had a rudimentary air force, an armed fleet, and the support of the government. But they were defeated by a group of militants with AK-47s and RPGs.
The United States Empire, NATO, it is in decline. The United States is not able to maintain its military personnel all around the globe, to be able to maintain over 600 military bases around the world. And so the United States, as the world police or the alleged peacekeepers of the world, is a myth. It's gone. The concept of the United States intervening in countries for, whether it be under the pretext of human rights, the rights of women, the rights of minorities, or weapons of mass destruction, as it was the case for Iraq, is a lie, because it's no longer possible for the United States to maintain this status.
The current security situation in Afghanistan today was a disaster almost two decades in the making. The collapse of the Afghan government made it clear that the U.S. 20-year endeavor to turn Afghanistan's military into an independent fighting force has failed. By retreating, the U.S. has given up on its failed project and has told its allies that Washington's support is no longer unbounded. Venezuela's government and the opposition began a new round of talks to end a years-long political impasse and economic crisis in the Latin American country on Friday in Mexico City. The two sides signed a memorandum of understanding containing the roadmap that will guide the dialogue process. The dialogue is mediated by Norway and hosted by the Mexican government. The government of President Nicolas Maduro has called for the lifting of the sanctions imposed by the United States and Europe against Venezuelan officials and institutions. On the other hand, the opposition has demanded the government to release dozens of people it considers as political prisoners and provide guarantees that they can run in the regional elections due in November. In addition, they have requested the government to allow humanitarian aid, including COVID-19 vaccines, to enter the country. In 2019, the Venezuelan government abandoned talks that took place in Barbados and Norway after the U.S. stepped up sanctions against the Maduro administration. In 2016, the Vatican supported similar talks that also failed. Furthermore, the plan for recent talks ran into trouble when the government rejected one of the opposition's envoys. Representatives of President Maduro refused to take part in the meeting if the opposition leader Juan Guaido's ambassador to Washington remained on the delegation. Venezuela says the U.S. sanctions are responsible for the country's current economic crisis.
That is the number one issue facing Venezuelans, because the sanctions are designed to break the Venezuelan economy and cause hunger on a mass scale. So if that can be challenged and pushed back even by a small bit, that would be incredibly important for all Venezuelan people. So I think these are fair parameters to go into the negotiations with. These are fair conditions, and the fact that the opposition is now coming to the negotiating table is a sign that they haven't got too many other options. This is, you know, after 2 years of trying to launch coups, calling for invasions, that they're now looking at the peaceful route is enormously positive, I think.
Washington and several of its Western allies have backed opposition leader Juan Guaido and imposed crippling sanctions on Venezuela in a bid to oust President Nicolas Maduro. The government says it won't bow down to what it calls blackmail by the United States in the upcoming talks. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed that Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy against Maduro. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reaffirmed the U.S. recognition of Guaido as interim president and has ruled out negotiations with Maduro anytime soon. The United States has refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, frozen millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in U.S. bank accounts, and imposed sanctions on the crisis-hit economy of the Latin American nation. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington is attempting to use sanctions as leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro, while freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new. The U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people, who are stuck between the coronavirus pandemic and an economic crisis. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of Maduro administration, but impact the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst the COVID-19 crisis.
Fierce clashes have been ongoing in recent weeks between Afghan government forces and the Taliban militant group. But the government troops haven't been able to keep the Taliban from making rapid advances across the country. In the past few weeks, the militant group has managed to capture half of the provincial capitals in Afghanistan, including the country's second largest city, Kandahar. According to estimates, the group is now in control of nearly two-thirds of the country.
Nobody with 75,000 troops or 100,000 troops can take over a whole country with practically no resistance, and thousands and thousands and thousands of your so-called enemy just surrendering and saying, here, take the weapons, unless they have some kind of meaningful political support. So whatever has happened in Afghanistan over these years, we're not back at ground zero. There is a change in the political climate in the country.
U.S. intelligence officials are reportedly predicting that the Afghan capital, Kabul, will be isolated in a month and will be taken over in a matter of 90 days. In the meantime, the United States and Britain have urged their nationals to immediately leave Afghanistan, with Washington announcing it's temporarily deploying 3,000 U.S. troops to Kabul to help evacuate American citizens and diplomatic staff. The advances of the Taliban have led the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, to replace the country's army chief. The United Nations Secretary General has called on the Taliban militants to halt their offensive in Afghanistan.
I call on the Taliban to immediately halt the offensive and to negotiate in good faith in the interest of Afghanistan and its people. I hope that discussions in Doha, Qatar, between representatives of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and the Taliban, supported by the region and the wider international community, will restore the best way to a negotiated settlement to the conflict.
Guterres warned that, quote, Afghanistan is spinning out of control. He told the reporters that seizing power through military force is a losing proposition that can only lead to prolonged civil war or the complete isolation of the country. He expressed concern over the early indications that the Taliban are imposing severe restrictions on human rights in the areas under their control. Guterres called on all parties to do more to protect civilians. His comments come as thousands of civilians are fleeing the violence across the country and seeking refuge in Kabul. The country's healthcare is also in bad shape, with health workers becoming overwhelmed as the number of people requiring medical attention has been on the rise. The U.S. is poised to withdraw all its combat troops from Afghanistan, ending its longest war in history by September 11th. That's despite the opposition from many American politicians who are saying it's doing so hastily.
We are doing what the British did for 100 years, trying to play these various peoples and games, one out off against each other, maintain Iran as the enemy, use Israel as our sort of fer de lance in the Middle East, support regimes from the 12th century, like Saudi Arabia. So sure, we hope Afghanistan becomes everybody else's problem.
The fact that the Taliban are seizing Afghan cities even before U.S. troops have officially left the country clearly shows that all funds the U.S. spent and all lives lost during the 20 years were for nothing.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has highlighted the unreliability of foreign providers of COVID vaccines to Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei said foreign providers of the vaccines initially reneged on their promises and refused sales. But things began to change course after Iran successfully managed to produce jabs against the deadly virus at home. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks during a televised speech on Wednesday amid a deadly pandemic wave that has gripped the country. Fortunately, the production of vaccines within the country paved the path for the import of foreign shots as well, whereas before that, foreign suppliers would renege on their promises despite having received the payments. The leader called on the executive bodies to double their efforts to procure vaccines, whether imported or domestically developed, and made them available to everyone.
We always have to look to the source of problems in the Middle East, and that is usually either the United States or Israel. In this case, I think we can see, or say fairly safely, that the United States is pressuring other countries not to sell vaccines to Iran in order to pressure Iran to re-enter the JCPOA. This is going to be a failed strategy, another failed strategy by the United States, which has never understood people's loyalty to their own government and has tried to bribe or intimidate countries to do the United States' bidding.
Ayatollah Khamenei hailed an initiative by President Ebrahim Raisi to set a one-week deadline for proposals on a comprehensive national response to the current peak of the outbreak. He said the response to the issue should be carefully weighed and any necessary measures adopted and enforced accordingly.
This is another example of that. By preventing other countries from selling vaccines to Iran, U.S. hopes that Iran will agree to concessions to rejoin the JCPOA. This simply isn't going to happen.
Iran is one of the few countries which has been able to produce vaccines against the deadly COVID virus after a year of intensive research using all internal resources and expertise. Iran joined the handful of countries that produced the coronavirus vaccine. The Ministry of Health later approved the Coviron Barakat vaccine that was jointly developed by Barakat Pharmaceutical Group and Shifa Pharmed Industrial Group. Iran's flagship coronavirus vaccine has hit a production milestone of 5 million doses nearly a month after it was approved for emergency use in the country. Iran has accelerated its inoculation drive against the coronavirus since earlier this month, after the health ministry announced that it can rely on abundant supplies of foreign jabs, as well as regular deliveries of vaccines that are being manufactured inside of Iran. The government says that it is determined to launch the production lot of domestic jabs, but stresses that vaccines must be imported from other countries to save people's lives. Knowledge-based companies, and especially those active in nanotechnology, are playing a major role in helping the vaccine production companies.
This is definitely an example of that, where U.S. sanctions once again have injured innocent people. We remember back in the early part of the millennium when Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State, was asked if the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children were worth U.S. sanctions. And she said, yes, it was. That's the U.S. attitude. The U.S. government does not care about the suffering of people.
Iran managed to produce vaccines despite being under cruel U.S. sanctions. The sanctions seriously undermined Iran's ability to battle the pandemic.
Iran could certainly have dealt with this pandemic much better than it was able to had the illegal and unjust sanctions not been issued. But Donald Trump issued them, violating international law and U.S. law by doing so when he violated the JCPOA. And the United States once again has blood on its hands, this time blood of innocent Iranians who would have been able to get the vaccine had the sanctions not existed.
The cruel and illegal sanctions denied Iran access to crucial raw material and necessary equipment.
In the limelight.
Republican members of Congress on Sunday, August 15, criticized U.S. President Joe Biden for spending time in the presidential retreat from Camp David instead of the White House as the Taliban fought to finalize the takeover of Afghanistan. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Fox News website. This article is published under the heading Biden hammered for spending time at Camp David as Taliban take control of Afghanistan. Stay tuned for more. Republican members of Congress on Sunday, August 15th, criticized President Joe Biden for spending time in the presidential retreat from Camp David instead of the White House, as the Taliban fought to finalize the takeover of Afghanistan. "Why is Joe Biden on vacation?" asked Representative Jim Jordan on Sunday morning Futures. "I don't think he answered a single question from the press this weekend, so it's a scary situation," he added. Fox News confirmed on Sunday, August 15th, that Afghan President Ghani fled the country as Taliban fighters entered the Afghan capital, Kabul. Asked Senator Tom Cotton, "Why is Joe Biden hiding?" Representative Lauren Boebert accused Joe Biden of dereliction of duty. Representative Jim Banks and Representative Elise Stefanik also echoed that criticism. Camp David has always been used for both business and recreation by U.S. presidents and is fully equipped with secure video conferencing technology. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said recently that Biden loves Camp David. Psaki continued, "It's a place to be outside, hang out with your family, and there is definitely some really beautiful scenery there." Two House Democrats have also taken to Twitter to criticize the Biden administration for the way it handled the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota noted, as the gold star son of the Vietnam War, listening to the White House briefing on the withdrawal from the war in Afghanistan, my heart pains, especially for the thousands of gold star families from an eerily similar and painful episode 40, 6 years later. Referring to Saigon, there is no way to hide it. The situation in Afghanistan is another shame for this administrator. Withdrawal was never going to be easy, but it didn't have to be, said Representative Vincent Gonzalez of Texas. The United States must do everything in its power to help our partners and allies to protect our national security, he added. The White House tweeted a photo of Biden sitting at Camp David and taking notes during a video conference with his national security team. Biden speaks with Vice President Kamala Harris and members of his national security team from Camp David. And also on Sunday, August 15th, a White House official told Fox News that Biden had spoken to members of his national security team about the situation in Afghanistan and would continue to receive updates and be briefed throughout daytime. Jordan said he didn't believe the United States had seen anything so crazy in foreign policy since the Vietnam War, referring to the infamous final at the Saigon embassy, where Americans were evacuated from a rooftop by helicopter in 1975. Hopefully, we can protect American lives, but that wouldn't happen. This wouldn't happen if President Trump was in the White House. We know we would not be treated the way we are by our opponents, Jordan said, adding, we wouldn't have had what happened in Anchorage, Alaska a few months ago, where Secretary Blinken was treated the way he was by his counterpart. It just wouldn't happen when you project the strength and confidence of the White House. But unfortunately, we don't have that today. The White House did not respond to Fox News' request for comment on GOP criticism on Sunday, August 15th.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Hussein, 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 I cry for you in pain, I cry for you. I cry for you in pain.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 19th, 2018. It is for the people to be set free from corruption, subordination, lowliness, and ignorance. It was for this reason that when Imam Hussein alayhi salam left Medina in a message to his brother Muhammad ibn Hanafiya, and in reality a message to the history, he wrote, "I am not rising out of selfishness or lust for power, nor to cause mayhem or pain. I rise looking for the correction in my grandfather's ummah. I see that things have changed in the society that the Prophet left. It is going towards the wrong direction, towards corruption. It is against the direction coveted by Islam and the Prophet had preached. I rise to fight against these vices."
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein.
Ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Ana latshan.
Ana latshan.
Imam Hussein's fight had two dimensions and can have two different fallouts. Nonetheless, both outcomes are good. One result was that Imam Hussein could defeat Yazid's government and take power away from those who oppressed the people and devastated the fate of the people, so he could arrange things in an appropriate way. If this had happened, the route of history would have revolved. Another dimension was that if Imam Hussein could not, for whatever reason, achieve political and military victory, then he would not by words, rather by blood, by resisting oppression, by a language that history will never forget, make his narrative flow like a perpetual and non-interruptible stream in history. This is what Imam Hussein did. Of course, those who claimed to be believers, if they had acted differently than what they did to Imam Hussein, the first case would have happened and Imam Hussein could have reformed the world. and the hereafter at that time. But the people did not cooperate. The discussion about why and how the people did not act appropriately is a very long and exhausting discussion, which I elaborated to some extent some years ago under the title The Common People and the Elite. It included who failed to act properly, who was responsible for this behavior, how they behaved, and in which areas. I'm not going to mention this discussion now.
Packing their bags and leaving behind a country laying in ruins. British troops and nationals following their American counterparts out of Afghanistan. Just as it was at the time of the war in 2001, criticism is rife of the so-called cross-Atlantic alliance's handling of the deepening crisis and indeed of the outcome of the 20-year occupation.
This is the biggest betrayal. I know the West have betrayed us in the 90s when we fought against the Soviet Union. You know, when Britain and America brought every terrorist to Afghanistan, including Bin Laden and others, they brought them to Afghanistan and they left them there. When the Russians were defeated, they left and abandoned Afghanistan. And when 9/11 happened, you know, suddenly they realized, you know, there are terrorists in the world. There is a regime called Taliban.
Touted as the war on terror, the military conflict in Afghanistan has cost the UK more than 450 troops and at least £37 billion in taxpayer money, roughly £2,000 per household. As their retreat from Afghanistan descended into a shambles, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called on Parliament to reconvene next week to discuss the situation on the ground. A little too late.
If I were the British, you know, military personnel, I would be suing the British government for sending my kids to Afghanistan. Those who were killed, you know, they should claim compensation from the British government for the betrayal and you know, the chaos and the mayhem and the anarchy they have, brought back to Afghanistan after 20 years of illegal occupation.
It is now the morning after, and Britain and other colonial powers have the task of finding what they call like-minded powers not to recognize the Taliban's rule.
In a matter of weeks, the Afghans, and indeed the rest of the world, woke up to a new reality. The Taliban, back in power, 20 years after they were toppled by the U.S.-led coalition, handing the U.S., the U.K., and their other NATO allies a humiliating defeat with long-term consequences. Saeed Pariza, London.
Washington's so-called war on terror has failed in Afghanistan as the Taliban are now back after 20 years of fighting against the US-led forces. The militants entered Kabul with facing almost no resistance. Afghan ousted President Ashraf Ghani fled the country, saying he left Afghanistan because he wanted to avoid bloodshed.
I congratulate this great victory on the entire Muslim nation of Afghanistan, particularly the honorable residents of Kabul and our Mujahideen. We didn't expect such a fa-